It seems that we have been waiting for this moment for a long time. My, how we have looked with longing to this hour when we could have Dr. and Mrs. Jasper MacPhail, our very first Southern Baptist missionaries to India, here with us today. Dr. Jasper MacPhail heads the Department of Thoracic Surgery at the Christian Medical College and Hospital in Vellore, South India. This is one of the few hospitals in all of Asia with such a department that is adequate for open heart surgery. He was assigned to this responsibility 2 years ago, having already spent 2 years in Vellore as an instructor and surgeon. Mrs. MacPhail is a certified registered nurse anesthetist, and Dr. and Mrs. MacPhail have had this mission interest ever since they were students in college. In fact, they too, as some others we have introduced from this pulpit, were student summer missionaries. And this really is how they met and how their romance began, as they went to missionary conferences in preparation for student summer work. Dr. MacPhail was assigned to Mexico that summer, and Mrs. MacPhail spent her time in Nigeria, working at the hospital in Eku, Nigeria. Dr. MacPhail is from Tennessee, did his pre-graduate work there, and then his college work there, and then came to Texas to the Baylor Medical Center and University for his doctor's degree. Mrs. MacPhail is from Tennessee. Dr. MacPhail is the author of the adult book that we will study this fall, our Foreign Mission Series book. And the name of his book is Beneath the Himalayas. And you will perhaps find this on sale right here at the bookstore during these days. We have been promised that it would be in during these days. I shall never forget the experience that I had when the manuscript arrived and when I read this thrilling story written by Dr. and Mrs. MacPhail, by Dr. MacPhail, but I believe Mrs. MacPhail had something to do with it too. But this thrilling manuscript, when it came, I was in a lonely, very cold, cold hotel room late at night. But I forgot all about being far from home and about being cold as I finished that manuscript in the wee small hours of the morning. And I have not forgotten one particular statement that Dr. MacPhail made in that manuscript. For he said this: until we have identified ourselves with a man's human needs, it is doubtful if we have the right to enter the sanctuary of the soul. And Dr. MacPhail, late that night, as I put down the last page of that manuscript, I thanked God that you and Mrs. MacPhail were in India. I thanked him that there is balm in Gilead and that it is being applied today in India.
Namaste. Now I see that you are not properly educated in Oriental culture, or you would have responded likewise with my All India greeting and handshake. This gesture was the first thing that I learned after I entered India. The second thing that I learned was how to wear the Indian sari, which I have worn for you today. Now, I do not feel that I have worn a costume, for the sari is a very natural part of my wardrobe. The wearing of the sari is an old Indian custom in which the women take great pride, and they seldom change their style, even though they may be living abroad. I think you will agree with me that the sari is the most beautiful and the most feminine of all women's dresses in the world, and I enjoy wearing the sari. The general attitude in India is that short dresses are for little girls, and ladies wear long dresses. You can imagine my culture shock upon arriving in the United States and seeing that the latest ladies' fashions were seemingly designed for little girls. Both wearing the sari and giving the traditional greeting cause Indian faces to light up in a smile of approval that we have made ourselves enough at home to enjoy their customs. Soon after my arrival in the country, as I was practicing my Indian greeting, the man whom I was addressing broke into a broad smile and he said, "I'm so glad to see that you have very quickly learned our handshake." And he added, "I like the Indian handshake much better than I do the American handshake, don't you?" As I thought about his question, I realized that the Indian handshake does have some advantages, because as one touches only his own hands with palms together, it is thereby possible to avoid our more forceful preachers who attempt to translate the power of the sermon into the power of the handshake, leaving the fingers crushed and limp throughout the week as a reminder of the Sunday worship service. But he interrupted my reverie saying, "I don't like the American handshake because I don't like to touch the dirty hands of other people." Now his statement was quite a shock to me, for never had such been my thoughts. However, as I lived and worked for 4 years in his country, I gradually came to understand the basis of his statement. His feelings came from a background of life's experiences and a culture as far different from mine as his country is far distant from mine. And as I thought about his remark, I realized that focused in this one statement, it is possible for one to see some of the biggest problems which India faces today. I don't like to touch the hands of other people in the American handshake because there are just too many of those hands. The major Indian problem is overpopulation. I have often wondered at the origin of the Indian handshake, but no one was able to tell me of its beginning. However, I have privately decided that it must have been designed by an efficiency expert running a political campaign. For the president of India can shake hands with 10,000, 20,000, or even 100,000 people in a moment. And such is a necessity in a country which faces a critical problem of population explosion. The population of India is approximately 480 million. This is equal to the combined population of Russia and the United States, while the land area of India is only about a third that of the United States. The government has launched a mass program of population control, and yet it doesn't seem to scratch the surface. The Indian Minister of Health recently said that India needs a 5-year holiday from babies. However, the custom is to have large families, especially among the poorer classes and illiterates. Their argument, and true enough, an epidemic may come along and wipe out all the children at once, and they must depend on the children for their old age security. And the upper classes argue, and true enough, if they limit their families, then the illiterates will soon overrun the country. And I don't like to touch the hands of other people in an American handshake because many of them are thin due to malnutrition. Certainly, the food shortage cannot be separated from the population problem. Primitive farming methods, spoilage, drought, and other factors make the harvest this year 12 million tons of grain short of what it was last year. As you see, distress could turn into outright starvation. But with an increase in population of between 10 and 12 million per year, it is not surprising that the food problem is of such overwhelming proportions. One Indian government official in New Delhi recently lamented, "It's like a flood. It just keeps coming on you. Every year we need an additional 2.5 million tons of grain just to stay even with the growing population." Now, half of the people in India are vegetarians for religious reasons, which causes a very heavy dependence on grain. Massive agricultural programs are underway to increase the yield of their exhausted land. However, in the meantime, food must be obtained from other countries, and the people must learn to eat new foods according to what grows best on the land. I don't like to touch the hands of other people in the American handshake because many of these hands are covered with diseases. Familiar to every tourist in India is the leper with his outstretched nubs calling bakshish or alms. And some of these hands are covered with the scabs of smallpox. Other hands display to us rare tropical diseases. And since I'm a nurse, I'm constantly reminded that hands are responsible for spreading the billions of microorganisms which perpetuate many of the serious diseases of the country: typhoid, cholera, tuberculosis, dysentery, parasites, and so many other things. And I don't like to touch the hands of other people is a statement which we might hear from a man referring to a woman. It is still very much a fact that among the middle and lower classes, the man considers himself superior to the woman. When the British arrived in India in the 1600s, the legal and social position of women was at its lowest ebb. Polygamy, child marriage, were customary, and the custom of suti, or the cremation of the widow upon her husband's funeral pyre, was very much practiced. And many of the women lived in complete seclusion. Through the years, social reformers and missionaries have gradually improved the status of women. It was probably Mahatma Gandhi who contributed most to change the attitude toward the role of women, for he used them in his various campaigns. And former Prime Minister Nehru sponsored many reform bills to improve the legal position of women. However, many Indian women are still bound by ancient traditions of behavior that emphasize her complete obedience to her husband and her complete submission to his every wish. For example, the dutiful wife still walks 3 paces behind her husband, never beside him, to show that she is his inferior. However, the status of women of the upper class compared to the lower classes presents the widest gap imaginable. Among this small group, there are numerous outstanding Indian women. India is the first major world power to accept a woman as prime minister, and perhaps no other major world power will be ready to do so for several years to come. However, I see that Mrs. Wallace is working her way up. When Indira Gandhi was chosen as prime minister, the fact that she is a woman seemed much more surprising to Americans than it did to Indians, because Indian women enjoy far greater political influence than do American women. There are 95 Indian women elected to the national legislature, and there are 195 elected to the state legislatures. The ruling Congress Party specifies that 15% of its candidates must be women. Now, the prime reason is that women took an active part in the struggle for freedom, and they won their right to political leadership. And from the statement, "I don't like to touch the dirty hands of other people," we catch a glimpse of the caste system. The caste system has been outlawed in India. But don't we know that old customs die hard? The caste system sees walls of partition being broken down, but certainly it is still a very important part of Indian life. There are 4 major castes, Brahmins being on the top. A 5th lower class are called the outcasts, also known as untouchables. Gandhi led the way to banish untouchability. He renamed these people Harijans, which means the chosen ones of God. Now the government gives them a favored position, reserving for them certain places in schools and certain government jobs. But the caste system is not as simple as my explanation might seem. with the four major castes and the outcasts, for there are 3,000 subcastes. The best picture is obtained by imagining a layer cake with 3,000 layers, the Brahmins on the top and the outcasts on the bottom. I don't like to touch the hands of other people in an American handshake because they might be of a different religion from me, and religious groups do not mingle freely. The caste system belongs only to Hinduism, the majority religion in India, but the minority religions have become isolated to a point where they have become almost like castes. For generally, these groups live separately, go to school separately, and marry separately, only within their own group. Islam is the second largest religion. About 10% of the population is Muslim. Other groups are the Sikhs, Parsis, Jains, Buddhists, and Christians. Christians of all faiths constitute only the small percentage of 2% of that tremendous population. Perhaps due to no fault of its own, but due to the external circumstances, Christendom too has become a separated and an isolated segment of Indian society. The handshake with palms together symbolizes to me these peoples of isolation and separation. For you see, my hands reach out to no one, but they extend warmth from me to myself. My hands offer love to no one but my family. My hands give help to no one except those of my particular community. I am reminded this morning that Jesus came into a culture which also had rigid lines of class distinction, isolation, and separation, but he lovingly extended his hands to others. He had compassion on the multitudes. He cleansed the lepers and healed the sick. He spoke to the woman at the well, lowering himself while elevating her. He made of himself no reputation while mingling with publicans and sinners. He invites us to extend our hands in brotherhood to all nations, but we cannot offer our handshake of friendship and turn our backs at the same time. Touching the hands of other people means that I become aware of their problems. Becoming aware of their problems, I become concerned. Becoming concerned, I become involved. And becoming involved costs me something. For some of us, the price is going as missionaries. For some of you, the price is sending sons and daughters. For some, the price is giving of financial resources. For others, the price is staying and praying. No, I don't like to touch the dirty hands of other people, but the love of Christ constraineth me.
Southern Baptists have waited for 150 years to have a missionary report to them on India. Shortly before Dottie and I went out to India in 1962, a little lady came up to me and said, "Son, have you learned to speak Indian yet?" You see, India to her was only a blur on a map far away. She did not know that India had 14 major languages and over 800 other languages and dialects. That blur in her mind was partially due to the fact that Southern Baptists had never had missionaries in India. At least I like to say that the Apostle Thomas was the first Baptist missionary in India. The legend is that he preached in South India in the first century. And actually, there's a great more historical evidence that he did preach in South India in 52 AD than that Peter was in Rome. And I don't have to tell you that an entire church group pins its existence upon the fact that Peter was in Rome, or upon the premise that Peter was in Rome. There is a group in South India today that call themselves St. Thomas Christians. They're far from Baptists. They are Syrian Orthodox Christians, very similar to the Greek Orthodox Christians whom you may know. I also like to say that we're probably really the first Southern Baptist missionaries since Luther Rice. I am in India today because in the early 1950s I read the story of Luther Rice, how he and Judson went out to India over 150 years ago together representing the Baptists of America. Judson was deported to Burma, where he did one of the most outstanding pieces of missionary work in all of our annals. Luther Rice was returned to America to try to mobilize the forces of Baptist people for the missionary cause. I think that he is the greatest unsung hero in Southern Baptist history. With a burning desire to return to India, which never left him the next 40 years of his life, he went along up and down the eastern seaboard and into the south, mobilizing people for missions. And our entire missionary structure today owes its beginning to Luther Rice. And in the early 1950s, I found it very difficult to understand why no Southern Baptist had recaptured the vision of Luther Rice for India. That's not really true. Other Southern Baptists have captured the vision, but they have gone to India with other mission boards or with other organizations. The president of the most outstanding Baptist seminary in India is Dr. Maurice Blanchard of Chattanooga, Tennessee. I think he's the most outstanding Southern Baptist in India. He's there because he went to India where God called him with the American Baptists and has done a most priceless piece of work there. We had a period of consultations with the mission board over the years. And as you well know, it became possible in 1962 for Dottie and me to go to India, actually as the only Southern Baptist missionaries to India supported by Southern Baptists. And this was truly a great breakthrough. I remember one day in 1957, I received a letter from one of the personnel workers, and it was actually one of the darkest days which I ever faced as a missionary volunteer. I felt so very, very deeply that God was calling me to India. I felt that that door there must be cracked open some way or other. And in my mind and by investigation, I knew that it could not be done except in specific ways. We must learn to meet the needs of the people that are there and then try to match that need and get in. And I thought that one of those possibilities was through medical education. And I had written about the possibility of remaining in the States longer and specializing, so that I would be qualified as a medical school teacher, not so that I could be different from my other fellow physicians. I remember thinking long and hard about it and praying about it. And finally, I came to this conclusion that I am responsible to God to do that which I feel He calls me to do. And I have enough confidence in Southern Baptists to believe that if He's calling me, He's calling them, and that together we'll be able to attack this situation. Well, of course, it's a marvelous story, It was a tremendous experience in prayer, much of which I never voiced to anybody around me. I thought about going with Presbyterians. They needed a doctor. And they are marvelous people. But you all know that I became a Christian as an adult, and I became a Southern Baptist for particular reasons. Certainly, other groups have the gospel. Certainly, Southern Baptists make mistakes. But Southern Baptists had a positive approach, and they were doing something about the world situation. And at the central core, they were right. The motive was right. And their methods of attack were more right than anybody else. And as I would pray about this, I would think, you know, Dottie's Southern Baptist. And actually, Lord, you're almost Southern Baptist. And I just don't think I can leave both of you. And it was a marvelous time. And when, after we were appointed to Nigeria, that Dr. Cawthon and Dr. Crawley asked us to have lunch one day with them and told us that we have decided that the Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Board will support you to India if you can find a place to go there. And I could tell you from now to the rest of the evening the many steps and hurdles which one by one were passed in order that this dream might come true. Today I would like to tell you a little bit about India. Dottie has introduced you to a most fascinating land. India is made up of 480 million people with two Southern Baptist missionaries. This is like saying one missionary for all of North America, Canada and Mexico included. And needless to say, my face is slightly red when I see the missionary map with India colored red. One missionary for each 240 million people. It's not a scratch on the surface. It's not a drop in the ocean of what we should be doing. These people are as different as Americans are different. There's no way to describe a typical Indian. They vary all the way from the Punjabi of North India, the tall and stalwart and well-nourished, muscular Sikh wearing his turban. He who is idealistic and who is the soldier of India. The Punjabis are often called the Texans of India. And I have been told that if my parents had been Indian, I would have probably been a Punjabi. Then in the south, there is this small, statured, finely featured, very dark-skinned Dravidian. And then in between, there are all different types of people between these variations. From the northeastern corner of Assam to the tip of India, you will find more different social and religious customs than you do in all of the Americas. As Dottie has told you, India is tolerant to all groups and all religions, but they tolerate different groups as the oyster tolerates the grain of sand by building a wall around it and completely immobilizing it. India is like a house which appears on the outside to the observer as a thing of unity. But to one who's been there, you will know that there are many separate rooms in that house and very, very few channels of communication between them. Indian people are hospitable. In fact, outside of the United States of America, I have never met any warmer hospitality than the Indian people have shown us. They have been generous to us in friendship. They are happy people in many situations. Most of you have only seen Calcutta. But in the villages where there may be just as much poverty, still there are smiles on their faces. And they seem to be telling us that you actually want things for us which we don't even know to want for ourselves. We have learned to be happy in the situation in which we find ourselves. They shared this happiness with us as they invited us into their homes and as they showed us every mark of friendship throughout our 4 years there. The Indian government officials are unusually friendly and helpful. As you know, politically, India is a democracy. Of course, with approximately 85% of the population unable to read and write, the democracy is not just exactly as we know it here. But at least among the educated classes, there is an aristocratic type of democracy, which has given to India one of the most stable governments of all of the emerging nations. We feel perfectly safe and secure in India. We're all very happy with the magnificent and charming way in which Madam Nehru has taken the seat as Chief of State. She is a woman of remarkable ability and deep understanding. She has a task which no other leader in the world faces today. A task of 480 million people on a very small piece of land, comparatively. A people who face hunger and who have learned to live and tolerate malnutrition. She faces a people that have the same desires as we have for a better standard of living and a new way of life. And they're impatient because they want it now. It took us in America many, many years to achieve it. And yet, somehow or other, Americans tend to feel that India should be able to achieve it in only 19 years. The task is overwhelming. And she is doing a remarkable job, along with the other leaders of India, to try to relieve the situation. And I would plead with us as Americans and with Southern Baptists who are in positions of leadership to be tolerant and deeply understanding of the phenomenal problems which the country faces. It would make us much less critical. Now, I would like to tell you something about the work which we do. First of all, as Dottie has mentioned, there are many different religions in India. Christianity has been there since the first century AD, according to their history. At least historically, we know for sure that a professor from the Christian College in Alexandria went there in 192 AD and found an established Christian community, which is testimony to the fact that Christianity probably was implanted in India in the first century. The Indians say that there was a Jewish community in Cochin, a port city, and that St. Thomas came there to preach the good news of the coming of the Messiah to the Jews who were expecting a Messiah. Other people say that he came there to preach Christ to the Brahmins. We know that someone early in the history of Christianity went to India, and that when our parents were still swinging from branches and that sort of thing in Europe, and before England was ever even inhabited, Christianity was in India. India has an old and beautiful culture with many things which we could learn to appreciate. And sometimes she doesn't think that we Americans are very highly cultured. Because after all, we're only infants. We're only 300 and something years old. At the outside margin, 500. And that's young in terms of India's measurement of time. So we're trying to work in a situation where Christianity has been present for 1900 years. This, over the centuries, has become an Orthodox type, Eastern Orthodox type of Christianity, which is very different from that which we have experienced. But it has produced a very highly cultured, highly educated, unusually capable group of Christians in India to whom the gospel is open, because they are some of the outstanding leaders, not only in the Christian community, but in all of India. They are responsible for the majority of the nurses in India, because the Christian girls go into nursing. Did you know that in India, where less than 2% of the people are Christian, that over 80% of the nurses are Christian? It's because the Christian young women have felt a call to service, whereas the Hindu young women have felt up until recently that nursing was actually beneath them. It was servant class work. And as you know, very seldom does a Muslim woman ever go into the professions. Most of the Muslim nurses are men. Dottie and I went to the Christian Medical College in Vellore, South India, to teach on the faculty there. This institution, as you will know, was founded by Dr. Ida Scudder, and most of you have probably read Mrs. Dorothy Clark Wilson's book entitled Dr. Ida. Others of you will have read Take My Hands by the same author, the marvelous story of Dr. Mary Verghese, a personal friend of ours, who has fought the battle of paralysis and yet has come out triumphant and is now head of the Department of Rehabilitation, Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Christian Medical College where we work. Truly a remarkable woman. And then recently released on our bookshelves is another book by the same author entitled 10 Fingers for God, which is the story of the unusual contribution of Dr. Paul Brand, a British surgeon who developed a reconstruction method for the hands of lepers and has brought new hope to the lepers around the world. And this is a very challenging story, especially to medical people, because the book is written where the doctor and the nurse can read it, and it sounds almost as if one of their own wrote it. And yet, it's easily readable to all. We work in that institution. I'm a thoracic surgeon. The waiting lists for thoracic surgery in India are so long, you would not believe it. Over 1,000 cases waiting to be operated on, and the list grows longer instead of shorter. I operate from 7:30 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, 5 days a week. That is just the daytime work. We are performing open heart surgery there, usually about 2 cases per week. And this usually means that I spend those nights all night long by the bedside, 2 nights a week. This is nothing unusual for thoracic surgeons, but this is a type of work which we are doing as medical missionaries. This is a part of my work, but my overall task in the institution is the training of young Indian thoracic surgeons. These people are selected from all over India to come there for training. They are sponsored by the government. We are allowed to have one seat for a Christian surgeon each year, and we take 2 new candidates each year. So at any one time, there are 4 of the candidates. It is a wonderful experience to be able to be associated with this unusually brilliant group of young Indian surgeons. Their mentality is such that it's almost frightening, because the competition to get the seat is stiff enough that they're just short of genius, those who get it. It's a very challenging task. And over the period of years, 5 of these people have gotten through their thoracic surgery training and are there working in the department now. This has tremendously relieved the strain of the work from my shoulders, and it's been a privilege to work with them. Within another 1 year or 2, any one of them will be capable of doing anything that I am capable of doing or ever have been capable of doing. And this is a joy of a task which is almost fulfilled. Dottie is a nurse anesthetist. And pardon my saying so, she's an unusually good one. She works every day along by my side. She gives anesthesia in the thoracic surgery room and in the neurosurgery room where they do brain surgery. So I work with her about 50% of the time. She puts the patients to sleep and I operate on them. It has been a task which we've enjoyed. We have opened our home as a student center for the 40 Baptist students in the different schools there of nursing, medicine, and paramedical studies. There are approximately 5 or 6 Baptist faculty members. It's been a real privilege each week as we've had this group along with other evangelical Christians worship in our home. I have taught a Bible class for young doctors on Friday nights, and from 15 to 30 of them have come. And not only have they studied Bible, but they have learned to lead the Bible study groups themselves, which I think will markedly influence their ministry when they go out to our Christian hospitals. And then on Monday nights, I have taught a preparation class for the teachers who teach Bible courses in the freshman classes of the medical and nursing schools. There wasn't time for all this I've named you. I don't know where the time came from or the energy, but throughout it all has been the singleness of purpose that this is what God has called us to do. And He has given us as Southern Baptists an unusual opportunity of contributing to the Christian community in India. And just before we left there, we were able to acquire the land on which to build a Southern Baptist hospital. This hospital will be built about 135 miles from Vellore in Bangalore. It will be a 150-bed hospital with a nursing school. The government has specified that it will be a teaching hospital where young interns and residents can come for training. It will mean that we'll have to have, certainly, the resources for building this. We'll have to have at least 4 doctors who are specialists, preferably 1 in surgery, 1 in obstetrics, gynecology, 1 in pediatrics, and 1 in internal medicine. But also, doctors could be used in other fields, such as anesthesiology. We will need a hospital administrator. We will need 2 nurses with master's degrees to head up the nursing school. We will need approximately 2 nurses for the nursing service. A laboratory technologist, a chaplain is a must. Our personnel needs, our financial needs, and most of all, the prayers of Southern Baptists will sustain us as we get this work going in Bangalore. And we pray that as we undergird the evangelical work in Bangalore with our hospital there, and as we join in Christian witness with the 5 or 6 other little independent Baptist fellowships in Bangalore, that we will be able to present the gospel of Christ to this needy land. Our challenge. I would like to challenge Southern Baptists to get with the task now. We are Johnny Come Latelys to India. We are the Rip Van Winkles of Baptists. How much longer will we wait? We have the opportunity now, the only denomination which has been allowed to enter India since independence. And yet, we seem to be moving sluggishly along. Now, it's very hard to present a challenge to WMU, to Women's Missionary Union, because they've been out ahead of the rest of us for a long, long time. You see, in India, the man goes first 3 paces. In Southern Baptist life, the WMU is 10 or more paces ahead. And it's very difficult to present a challenge to WMU except the challenge of praying with us and going back to your churches and your organizations and sending us the personnel, even a son or a daughter. And of course, undergird us with the support through the cooperative program and the Lottie Moon Christmas offering. And then I would like to challenge the men of the Southern Baptist Convention. Before I went out to India, someone asked me, what would I recommend, or what would I do if I did not get appointed, or some health problem kept me from going? Just what would you do with your life? And I discussed this with some people in Fort Worth, and I said, one thing I would do, or help do, is organize an agency whereby dedicated professional laymen among Southern Baptists would have an opportunity of going and working alongside where we have mission work and undergirding our work there. And I think that our brotherhood could do this. Set up an agency that would keep a file catalog on outstanding young Baptist laymen who are also well-trained in their technical professions, and also keep a file on the companies that work where we have Southern Baptist work, such as government and oil companies, etc. And when these people have personnel openings, our agency would try to meet it. Now, these would not be career missionaries. These would be laymen who are specifically locating for the purpose of expressing their Christian witness. And I think we have an untapped source of gospel advance through something of this sort. This may not be the final answer. This is a suggestion. But I would like to challenge all of you as Southern Baptists to wake up to this world in which we're living. Is India still a blur to you, like it was to that dear lady that asked me, had I learned to speak Indian? Or this morning, is India in focus? If India is in focus today, please realize the urgency that it's in focus only today. Our opportunity is only for today. We must not let it recede to where it just becomes another blur in the minds and on the maps of Southern Baptists.
Across the crowded ways of life, where sound the cries of race and clan, above the noise of selfish strife, we hear the haunts of wretchedness and need, on shadowed thresholds dark with fears, from paths where hide the lures of greed, we catch the vision of thy tears. O Master, from the mountainside, make haste to heal the hearts of pain. Among these restless throngs abide, O tread the city streets again. Tis't sons of men shall learn thy love, and follow where thy feet have trod, till glorious from thy heavens. shall